It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. In Morgantown, Emily Johnson loves driving honeybees crazy.
Thai basil, which has these wonderful, we just let it bloom because there's more than enough to pull the leaves off and eat, and they just act like it's catnip or something.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. It's been more than 2 weeks since 48-year-old Eric Legg of Twilight and 46-year-old Gary Hensley of Chapmanville died in a Boone County coal mine. They were using an extraction method called retreat mining, referred to by safety advocates as the most dangerous form of mining. But as Jessica Lilly reports, that's not the only safety concern at mines in Boone County and throughout Appalachia.
Like several coal seams throughout Appalachia, Boone County's coal reserves have been substantially diminished after more than 100 years of mining. Mine operators are now producing coal from basically leftover coal reserves, in which even isolated instances of non-compliance of safety rules can cause substantial injuries and death. In 1995, the U.S. Bureau of Mines found that depleted coal reserves in Boone County will be able to sustain mining activity for no more than 20 years. Nearly 20 years later, we continue to mine coal in these last remaining reserves. Court documents show that at Brody No. 1, a seam of coal is being mined that's about 53 inches or almost 4.5 feet thick. And since we're talking about a geological formation, the thickness likely declines over distance. Imagine trying to maneuver equipment, machines, and even walk with a ceiling that low. The National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health pointed out that mining these thinner seams often means deliberately cutting into more rock formations other than coal. That often means increased risks of developing black lung disease as well. Sam Petsunk is with the nonprofit organization Mountain State Justice and director of the Miner Safety and Health Project.
When you're mining a thin coal seam, often an operator will mine adjacent rock to give themselves a little more space. Say if you're in a 36-inch coal seam or less, you're probably going to cut some extra top to give yourself extra space in the mine to maneuver. That means that you find yourself cutting non-coal rock, often quartz-bearing rock, which contains a highly toxic quartz dust.
So when mining low or thin coal seams, miners often cut substantial amounts of rock, often containing quartz or silica, above and or below the coal seam. As noted on MSHA's website, miners develop silicosis in their lungs through overexposure to dust containing silica. Silicosis is kind of like black lung disease on steroids. The quartz crystals cut, scar, and disable the lungs much more severely than coal dust. But these aren't the only increased risks in mines throughout Boone County and Appalachia. Not only is the Brody mine a low coal seam, but the company also uses the dangerous and often deadly method of retreat mining.
It is nerve-wracking.
Charlie Mouse Ashley is a retired miner who has experience working in a retreat mine setting.
When you're pulling pillows out of the mountain, you're taking away the support, and it will fall.
And that's the nature of the method. Essentially, miners are hired, in part, to remove coal and make the roof collapse on purpose.
Retreat mining is always dangerous, but especially in West Virginia, and especially in southern West Virginia now, where we're mining thinner seams and more discontinuous geology, attention to safety and proper planning is all the more important because the risks tend to be greater at greater depth and in more marginal coal reserves.
Miners carefully and skillfully cut away at pillars that are supporting a mountain above their heads. The company creates a roof control plan to determine the safest way to remove the supports and create the collapse.
Retreat mining is very dangerous, and it has a lot to do with their roof control plan. I can't emphasize enough.
Straying from the plan would mean the mine is non-compliant. The slightest variance can mean death. But as we discussed earlier, just the size of the seam creates a situation in which varying from the plan or regulations is easily, and advocates say, commonly done. A miner from Kentucky, concerned about his safety in a retreat mine, videoed the last moments of his life the day after talking to his wife about his concerns. In 2007, the Crandall Canyon accident left 6 miners dead. MSHA investigators found that an inadequate mine design caused the deaths. In wake of the Brody tragedy last month, safety advocates are sounding off once again about the dangers of retreat mining. Former MSHA leader David McAteer told the Charleston Gazette it should be abolished. This is nothing new. After Crandall Canyon, federal lawmakers discussed the dangerous practice during a U.S. Senate Appropriations Committee hearing. Even back then, there was talk of using a tool meant to improve mine safety in retreat mine settings, called seismic monitoring. Sam Petsunk.
Systems are available to provide real-time monitoring of seismic activity in the roof of the mine so that if pressurization displacement of mine top occurs, the system can detect that and inform miners how to plan around it, how to avoid it, how to stop those pressurization, that overpressurization or that displacement from causing bigger problems, causing injuries and fatalities.
The seismic monitoring technology has existed for several decades and is now more widely available and more commercially viable than ever before. It basically tracks geological activity in the ground. This information could be helpful in a mine setting to help determine increased pressure. There's also machinery that makers claim will reduce dust and follow seams more safely. It's commonly referred to as the low-coal longwall machine. The machine helped the Pinnacle Mine in Wyoming County set a record for most productivity. Petsunk also points out that by knowing their rights, miners are safer. The State Office of Miners' Health, Safety, and Training says the Brody Mine did not have a miner's representative, a right created by the Federal Mine Act that enables 2 miners to agree to elect a person to serve as the miner's representative.
And the miners should explain to the company what the miners expect and the conditions that they need to have. And, you know, somebody needs to be responsible to say this is how many roof bolts we need. We need 6-foot roof bolts, or we need tie straps, or whatever that we may need. That stuff needs to be ordered. So it has to be somebody that has some kind of knowledge of the job every day.
Among other things, a miner's rep can go with an MSHA inspector to point out safety concerns or suggest changes to things like roof control plans.
Roof control accidents account for a third of the underground mining fatalities in this country, and we can prevent these accidents. We can prevent them through better engineering, through involving miners in the mine planning process and improving miners' engagement in safe practices, and we can certainly also improve them by using available technologies.
The Brody Mine had a history of poor safety and was even recognized by MSHA as a pattern violator, a status that the mine is contesting with the Mine Safety and Health Review Board. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly.
Federal and state mine safety officials are still investigating the deaths of Eric Legg and Gary Hensley in the Brody Mine in Boone County. While honeybee colony collapse disorder is relatively uncommon in West Virginia, bees and pollinators are still threatened here and across the country. A third of all of our foods and beverages come from crops pollinated by these insects. There's growing concern that pesticides and certain farming practices are at the heart of the crisis, and more gardeners are stepping up to try to support pollinators in their own yards and fields. Glennis Board visited one home in Morgantown that's a honeybee's heaven. She brings us this report.
Emily and Bill Johnson of Morgantown are master gardeners, meaning they've been trained and either volunteer or teach horticulture through a National Master Gardener program. And they've become passionate quite accidentally about supporting pollinators. They attend classes and also now offer occasional classes about good gardening practices to support insects that do the important work of pollinating plants.
Well, we're looking across a little section of lawn, and there's a stone walkway that winds up the hill. And on either side of the walkway are planted areas with mixed trees and shrubs and lots of flowering plants.
Several hundred varieties of plants are growing in their garden. Right now, it's the height of flowering plants, so purple, blue, yellow, red, and white blooms of all shapes and colors are spread across the half-acre or so yard. The Johnsons became interested in supporting pollinators when they began accidentally attracting butterflies. What started as a desire to encourage more butterfly visits became an interest in encouraging visits from all sorts of pollinators, including honeybees and native bees, dragonflies, and even things like hummingbirds and bats.
I mean, we love the beautiful garden, too, so it's not just about gardening for insects. It's about gardening for people as well, gardening for ourselves.
Bill also points out that a butterfly is only an adult butterfly for a small portion of its total lifespan. And many other early incarnations of butterflies require very specific plants.
For example, the pipe vine swallowtail, that's a beautiful black and blue or purple butterfly. The caterpillar only feeds on the Dutchman's pipe vine. Growing over next to that dead maple tree, there's a Dutchman's pipe that we planted to feed the caterpillars of Dutchman's pipe.
The Johnsons also grow milkweed for monarch butterfly larvae. Monarchs are the big black and orange and white migratory butterflies that are in grave danger of disappearing because of loss of habitat and other factors. In fact, the Johnsons grow a variety of milkweeds, as well as other native and wild plants, because, well, apparently bugs love the native stuff.
Find a part of your garden that you can let go wild or as wild as you can stand it. And put native plants in, or things that people might think of as weeds. For example, this is mountain mint, which is a native plant. It's not a showy plant, but it's one of the most attractive to a variety of bees, especially the really small bees, because it has tiny little flowers.
Also, Bill suggests, instead of maintaining a lawn, keep a clipped meadow. He says while he didn't coin the phrase clipped meadow, it gets to the point. From about 20 feet away, you might be able to discern some clover or a dandelion in his yard, maybe. Bill shrugs when he says he's given up a monoculture grass lawn.
Clover is a legume, and legumes are the only plant family that I know of that actually fixes nitrogen out of the air and turns it into nitrates and puts the nitrogen into the soil.
Wow.
So there's a synergy between the clover and the grass. So, you know, why put chemical nitrogen on your lawn when you can have clover do the job?
The Johnsons admit that they aren't organic gardeners, but they, like many, are worried about pesticide use. According to a recent study by Harvard's School of Public Health, pesticides are at the heart of colony collapse disorder. And the Environmental Protection Agency indicates that there is data to implicate one of the most commonly used pesticides, called neonicotinoids. The agency reports that residue from the pesticide, quote, can accumulate in pollen and nectar of treated plants and may represent a potential exposure to pollinators, close quote. 30% of our food effusively depends on honeybees alone. The value of their pollinating services is often measured by farmers and economists in billions of dollars. And the Johnsons have come to learn that they, too, can take advantage of this free service to grow their own apples, blueberries, raspberries, and a lot of herbs, too.
A lot of what we grow that's important, not so much now, but especially later in the summer, are herbs. Things like thyme, oregano, lavender are all extremely attractive to bees.
Thai basil, which has these wonderful, we just let it bloom because there's more than enough to pull the leaves off and eat, and they just act like it's catnip or something. They just are all over the basil, and they really love the lavender.
Emily says as more and more information is being circulated on the subject of pollinators and gardening, farmers markets are a good place to get educated. And she also says you don't need a green thumb to grow some pollinator-friendly foods and plants.
anybody can help. You know, it's one of these things where everyone can get in on this. This is a fun thing, and especially with kids. That's, you know, kids like to plant things, and they like bugs. As long as they're not taught that there's anything wrong with bugs, they really seem to like bugs.
So let's recap real quick. 5 gardening tips from 2 Monongalia master gardeners on how to support pollinators. Ready? Got a pen? Okay. 1, if you have a lawn, avoid pesticides and learn to keep a clipped meadow instead. The weeds that want to grow there can actually help you in more ways than you might imagine. 2, grow native plants. Pollinators love them. 3, don't forget that supporting pollinators can mean thinking about butterflies, dragonflies, hummingbirds, bats, and native bees, in addition to the European honeybee. 4, try growing your own food that needs pollinators, apples, raspberries, blueberries, and herbs like thyme, lavender, and basil. And 5, anyone can do it, from almost anywhere, from a community garden to a box of herbs on your deck or in a window box. The pollinators will find you. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:45. Partly sunny skies today. There is a chance of rain and thunderstorms. Temperatures in the 70s and 80s today.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by Festival Charleston, June 20th through the 29th, with Festivalt, a new outdoor concert featuring drive-by truckers and the Carolina Chocolate Drops. FestivalCharleston.com. West Virginia, wild and wonderful.
Handbells. They aren't just for Christmas and Easter anymore. In Pittsburgh, the Three Rivers Ringers community handbell group is ringing in spring. The ensemble's performing classical waltzes, jazz, tunes by pop star Lady Gaga, and even wedding dance songs. Jennifer Sveta-Jordan has more.
In St. James Catholic Church in Sewickley, an unexpected song played on unexpected instruments rings out. It's a Sunday after regular church services let out for the day, but the pews are full. Standing around the altar facing the congregation are 15 women and men dressed neatly in black like orchestra pros with tight-fitting short black gloves. They're lifting and shaking and thumping dozens of bells for the Hava Nagila folk song, often heard at Jewish weddings. And this song isn't even the most unusual tune the group will play in the next hour.
Welcome to our spring concert, Shall We Dance?
That's Nancy Lutz, artistic director of the Three Rivers Ringers, and that's Duke Ellington's Don't Get Around Much Anymore. Now, Nancy Lutz is not just the leader of the Three Rivers Ringers, the Mount Lebanon resident, was secretary of the organization formerly known as the American Guild of English Handbell Ringers. She successfully lobbied to change the name to Handbell Musicians of America.
Because it is a valid musical art form. You know, today you saw at times 15 people ringing an instrument with many individual instruments in their hands.
The Three Rivers Ringers is one of a growing number of community handbell ensembles around the country. It started with the Raleigh Ringers about 20 years ago, performing what it calls unique interpretations of sacred, secular, and popular music, including famous rock and roll tunes arranged just for handbells. And spring is the time of year to catch these groups going way off the standard Christmas set list. So you'll have to forgive Lutz if she's inspired by pop star Lady Gaga's hit, Let's Dance.
I've talked about doing it for probably at least 3 seasons, and we finally put this dance theme program together, and of course we had to end with Lady Gaga.
The ensemble dons Technicolor plastic glasses, and one member wears a purple wig for the number. And going gaga over the group was audience member Carol Lewis from Aliquippa.
Their talent is just so good. And the comedy and, you know, the variety, everything.
Some members of the Three Rivers Ringers point out that while handbell choirs are inspired by modern music, the influence goes the other way, too. A group of ringers played backup to Icelandic singer-songwriter Björk in this 2009 performance of Who Is It?
Who is it? never let you down. Who is it that gave you back your crown?
No, I'm not doing it.
Oh, really? We have a partner for you.
Get up. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan.
Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.